As you know, or I assume you know, that this was actually a ministry responsibility this morning that was Michael Atwood's. And after he got here and we discussed it and the fact that he has to travel home all the way below Atlanta to his home in Georgia today and then fly, this is the tough part, to the Bahamas tomorrow, thought it was best that he leave early. He told me he would leave at quarter of, or around 3:30, 4 o'clock. I went down the hall at 3:45. I was actually checking on some girls on the other end of the thing. But anyway, at 3:45, and they were already gone. And his son told me they left at 2:30. I did hear one of his children crying, so maybe they just woke up and decided we might as well go. But anyway, that leaves me to fill in. I trust you've been praying. If you're not, start now. But I would like Mike to stand up first. Good object lesson, you know. All right, you can sit down. I'm just going to say what was said to me many times in our youth by an older brother, older than me even. And this is something you really want to put between your ears. And it may apply more to the ladies than to the men. Some of you have heard it before. What you advertise for is what you get. And some of you ladies, maybe the way you dress, you may attract, but you will get what you advertise for. Perhaps a young man that's interesting in what you're advertising. So really think that through. It can save you a lot of grief, and if you brush it off, it may cause you a lot of grief. Okay, at least in, when you go on to college, I don't know how it is in high school anymore, they give you electives. So I'm going to give you electives this morning. You're not going to you will vote, but your vote is not the end. I will ultimately decide. It's not congregational. You know what I mean by that? It's not congregational. Many churches, and unfortunately assemblies sometimes, are run congregationally. They take votes. It's not biblical to take a vote. It's what you have oversight for and overseers. So we're going to take a vote, but here are four topics we could cover this morning. Amazing grace. And by the way, they're all kind of worded maybe a little tricky because I probably gave all four of these before. And if I gave the real titles, you wouldn't vote for any. So amazing grace, last words, learning from failure, and an overview of the Bible. So how many want to hear amazing grace? Oh, that's good. We got two. We know it. Okay. Maybe that's one we should do then. Last words. All right. Learning from failure. I thought that might be one. Overview of the Bible. Okay, guess we'll have to go, even though I said it wouldn't be by vote, we'll go with learning from failure. Okay, that means I have to really rely on my notes this morning to do this, but that's what we'll do. By the way, I'll tell you what they would have been. Amazing Grace would have been a little study into the hymn Amazing Grace, the background of the writer. And then some lessons from the scriptures about grace. Last words would have been an overview of 2 Timothy, Paul's last words to Timothy, as applied to the last days. Overview of the Bible. That would have really been obedience. How many of you heard obedience before? Lesson on obedience. Hey, that's not too many. I can still change. No, we'll go with progressively worse. First Kings, learning from failure. First Kings. I thought you were out of commission for the day. Chapter 15. First Kings 15:5. Because David did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, and turned not aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life. Wouldn't it be great if it stopped right there? Except only in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. It's an amazing testimony, but isn't it an amazing testimony that we could have a great testimony, and then there's one thing that kind of, I won't say ruin it, but certainly diminishes its impact. By the way, would somebody turn the air down over there? Just, David, turn that to your left. Just turn to your left till it comes on. Is it running? No, I can't hear it up here. When you sit back, you hear it. Okay, thanks, Dave. We often say it could take years to build a testimony and seconds to lose it. We're always have to be on the guard. You know, we've built a patch in your school or where you work or in your neighborhood or whatever hopefully you've built a testimony. As someone who loves the Lord and is interested in spiritual things and perhaps doesn't do things that other people do, when I was stationed in Frankfurt, Germany, and that wasn't World War II, German beer, which was like twice the alcoholic content of what was available here and is available here, was available to us who were soldiers at the time for 15 cents a bottle. And there were many people around me who consumed it at a great rate. And they often said to me, why don't you drink? Is it because you're religious? And I would say to them, well, yes. Yeah, that's true. But it's also the point that if I don't take the first one, I don't have to worry about the second or stopping. And it's the same with drugs, isn't it? If you never take the drugs, you don't have to worry about stopping. If you never take the first drink, you don't have to worry. And so you can build a testimony, and it would just take one of those little things. And you know, if you're a Christian and you have a testimony, understand that the world expects more of you than they do of themselves. They have a higher standard for you. You claim a higher standard, and they expect it. And don't be surprised if they respect it, even though they don't say it. I used to have men who were drunk come to my door over there and, oh, give me fits. But you know, sometimes individually when they were sober, if we were alone, sometimes they had problems and they would come and talk to me, and other times they say, you know, we give you a hard time and all that, but I really appreciate the fact that you're consistent, that you say what you believe and you stick with what you believe. And the world around you is, if you have a testimony and you say you're a Christian, they expect better things of you. you go to work and you say you're a Christian, they expect you to be on time. They expect you to take the right length of break. They may take, if it's a 15-minute break, they may take a half hour, but they expect you to take 15 minutes. And rightly so, isn't it? Shouldn't they expect that if we claim and make that profession? And so here's David. He has a life that everything's okay except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And of course, that involves far more than Uriah the Hittite, doesn't it? And it's one thing interesting about the Bible. The Bible plays no favorites. You know, one of the great things that you could point out to people about the inspiration of Scripture is that the giants in the Bible, the Abrahams and the Moses and, you know, David and people like that and Peter, the Bible doesn't gloss over their mistakes. It really pinpoints them, and in some cases enlarges upon them. Whereas if men write them, you know, they're heroes, they typically would gloss over them or sweep it under the carpet. Not so with the Bible. God brings it right out to us. Now, when we come to the life of David and the failure of David, particularly with Bathsheba, and which obviously relates to Uriah, it's not a time to stand back and start throwing stones at David. Oh, look what David did. That was horrible. And it is. But it's a time really to learn, to see what were the steps that led to that failure. What transpired that you and I can learn from with David. One has said, this account of David is like a lighthouse warning us of the rocks upon which David's life was wrecked. Interesting description. That David's failure is like a lighthouse warning us of the rocks upon which David's life was wrecked. Those who have been here for a while probably heard me say I'm one of five sons, but my oldest brother, I'm the fourth, and he's the oldest, he's one who has always had little sayings. And one of his sayings is, there's only one thing worse by learning from experience. And that's not learning from experience. You, as young people, really ought to learn from experience of others if you can. It's a lot cheaper. Don't wait to disregard the instructions of your parents or the older saints or make little of them. You know, they're out of touch with reality and their days have passed. I remind you again, your parents know more about being young than you do about being old. Okay? I appreciate, you know, I hassle you, I get you to bed, I get you to your room anyway. And but I don't want to give you the wrong impression when I say this, but you're a piece of cake compared to when I sat where you sat. The men who had to get me to my room had to work a little harder. Not so much to my room or to sleep, but what was happening, let's say, in the free hours. Nothing bad in that sense, just typically where I shouldn't be, maybe being mischievous and things of that nature. But you really do want to learn from other people's mistakes. You know, you see people's mistakes, and sadly you might see other believers' mistakes, and maybe in your own family or maybe in your own assembly. Again, it's not a time to start, you know, writing them off. In fact, the scriptures would say it's a time that you really want to come alongside them in certain situations, and those who are spiritual restore certain ones. But you really want to learn. And you really want to avoid having to learn from your own experience. I'm going to make a statement now, and it seems hard, but I'm convinced of it the more and more I observe what's going on today. And it's not only young people your age. I experience this with young couples, people who are married, those who have young children. It seems we are now in a generation, and believe me, it wasn't like my generation didn't have this problem, but I think it's magnified. You don't listen well. Older people say things. Goes in this ear, out that ear. I'm not saying you only. Remember, I'm saying younger couples, people who are older than you. You say to them, older people say to them, you know, you take that path, that's just going to really make a problem on your family. There's going to be an impact on your family if you take that route. And it's like, and they go. I mean, they just go. And I just feel that you're living in an age when no one listens. So, listen. The amazing thing is, David had a heart for God. You know, you sing to him, isn't it? As the deer panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul for thee, O God. Do we stand around and make an expression like that? God, my heart pants after, you know, if you've seen deer in the wild, and we saw one this morning, at least I did. I think some of you saw, maybe some other. You know, you get them running and you get them chased. And they finally get to a place where they can rest and they come to the water. They're panting. They want a drink, just like you would want a drink if we forced you to run the loop. Some of you once, some of you halfway. You would be panting. You would want the water. Well, David says, you know, that's the way his heart was for God. He was a man for God, seeking God, wanting God. And so before we're too critical, think of that. God says he was a man after God's own heart. You know what, Mark David, and we're not going to get too far in this study, I can tell you, because this is a very long study. Well, you know what, Mark David, he was a man that was faithful in that which was least. You know how the Bible says, you know, what we want is a person who is faithful in that which is least. We all want the big jobs. We all want the responsibility. We all want the limelight. We all like to be the leader, perhaps. David was a shepherd. A lot of responsibility. Somebody else's sheep. Animals attacking them. But you know, the shepherd is typically off alone, out of the limelight, unseen. And many saints in our assemblies are like this. Labor unseen. I can't quote it exactly, but it was Brother Darby who said that really the greatest thing is to serve unseen and unnoticed. To learn to serve without perhaps recognition. You know, I was going to say, go cut the grass at your chapel at midnight, but maybe that wouldn't be a good idea, but you know what I mean. There are things you can do that you're not in the limelight, but the Lord looks for those that are least. And there's another principle in Scripture, isn't it? That when you give someone a function to do, you don't give them the top function. At boys camp, we don't bring on young men and say, okay, you're in charge of three cabins or you're now the director and, you know, we'll just sit back. No, what we do is we run them around for 2 years. We just say, go do this, go do that. We call them gophers. Go for this, go for that. Go here, do that. And what are we looking for? We're looking for young men who are willing to be obedient, willing to serve, willing to be faithful in that which is least. But the Bible says you give them a small task. If they handle the small task right, we give them a little larger task. If they handle that right, we give them maybe a little larger task. That's the biblical system. And I can say that this about my generation, that we who became, you know, perhaps there was a generation before me, but we became, you know, those who were educated. Our parents went through World War II. Very few of them had college degrees. They worked hard. My father worked 6 days a week in a sales office for Bethlehem Steel in Philadelphia. I remember it was a big deal when he finally went back to a 5 day work week. And he, because his father died when he was young, he quit high school, went and just stood in line over and over and over again looking for a job until the man said, you know, I recognize you. You've been through here many times. And he gave him a job as a mail clerk. And over 50 years, my father then became ultimately the manager of the Philadelphia sales office. But those of us who were educated, you see, when we came out of college with one or two degrees, we expected to be the manager of the sales office almost immediately. We wanted to be moving and on the top. After all, we were educated. But that's not the biblical pattern. The biblical pattern is that you show yourself faithful, and then the Lord and others perhaps bring you along in a different way. And David was faithful. And of course, David had many victories, and we know that he killed Goliath and also became king of Israel. But talk about the fall and the folly of David. David, and this is a key word, inadvertently came into temptation. It wasn't like David said, I think I'm going to go down to the red light district in center of Philadelphia or any other large city and, you know, see what's available. David was not out looking to commit adultery. It wasn't like he planned it. And often, this is the way we fall. It isn't that we sit back and say, you know, tomorrow I'm going to fall, or I'm going to go commit this horrible sin. It comes upon us in an unplanned fashion. And that means that we must be alert. And this is where David falls. Because quite frankly, David is where he shouldn't be. David is on vacation, spiritually speaking. His men are out fighting, and when the men were fighting, he should have been with them and leading them, but instead he comes home and goes a little R&R. That's rest and recuperation for those of you maybe who don't understand the military. They used to give us R&R. And David is relaxing. He's on vacation. And this is what happens when we take a spiritual vacation. And we decide, you know, I've been going to the chapel so faithfully, and tonight I'm tired, and I don't know, I think I'll just take a little break. Or maybe I've been reading, you know, faithfully, but now, you know, I have this earlier class, and I think I'll take a little break. Be careful of spiritual breaks and spiritual vacations. And David sees a beautiful woman bathing without regard to modesty. Obviously, open rooftops. He's on his, she's on hers. And by the way, ladies, this should say something to you that more often, perhaps, than you realize, the opposite sex is watching. And they're not always watching in a way in which, you know, you're even obvious of it. Now, I'm not saying they're going around hiding behind trees. You know? Might be, but. But they're more observant and more aware than perhaps you give them credit for. Just because they don't come up and try to arrange a date, you know, doesn't mean that they're not watching and observing. They are. And particularly sometimes, you know, it's not because they plan it. You know, they're walking down the street and this lady comes out with a dress style that is obviously something that would get one's attention. He didn't plan it.
And neither did David plan it. He begins by inquiring about her. Sometimes some of you come to me and inquire about people. It's okay. It's not a bad idea. But he inquires in the wrong way. And he's told she is someone else's wife. Now you would think that would just, well, that's the end of that. But not so. And he's informed that she's Uriah's wife, but what else is true of Uriah? He's away. He's not home. He's out where David should have been, fighting. And David commits adultery with her. But that which was done in secret is about to become public. She's going to start to enlarge. You know, what they had done secretly now is beginning to show, or going to show. And often that's the way it is in our life too. Sometimes we think that these things, perhaps certain situation, well, it's done in secret. Of course, it's never done in secret, is it, with regard to God? The eyes of God are everywhere. That's what the Bible says. The eyes of God are everywhere. Sometimes at boys' camp, that's what they attribute to me. The eyes of God are everywhere. I did that one time at a Christian school, and sure enough, after school, there was this young man riding in front of me in his car, and he didn't know that I was following. And he had the music going, the so-called Christian music going. It was vibrating his car and my car. And he had a milkshake, and it was shaking. The next day in class, I said to him, "Hey, I saw you yesterday in your car with a milkshake and the music." He was shocked, because I just said the day before, you know, guys of God are everywhere. Not that I was saying I was God, but but people are observing. And obviously, it wasn't done in secret for God. But that which was done, he thought secretly with regard to men, came out. And David's first attempt to cover up his sin is to call Uriah back. And you know what that was? To send Uriah in to his wife. "Look, take a break like I'm taking a break. And go home and spend the night with your wife." When I grew up, I had a friend who we were very close. Did many things together. I threw him more touchdown passes than Jerry Rice has ever received. What's the other guy's name? Montana the Rice. Threw him more touchdown passes than that. Very close. And his mother would often come to me and put her finger in my face. "Stephen, remember this. You never fall alone." What was she saying? She was saying, you know, if you fall, you're going to take my son with you. And so here's David now trying to incorporate Uriah in this plot involving other people. And of course it doesn't work because Uriah is a neat guy. He says, I can't do that. My men are out there fighting. They're out there living in the field and a little bit like Gettysburg, you know? Tents and battle and war. You want me to go home and just spend a night of ease? Can't do that. So he does what? He gets them drunk and everything else and, you know, all the plans. And none of them work. So ultimately he has to do what? He has to give the command when he goes back to the field. The leader there is given the field, put him up front in this battle. Why? Because he wants him, and then withdraw from him. Not only put him up front and then back off, leave him out there alone. And he's killed. That's exactly what David wanted, and in reality, it was murder. Now just think of this now. I mean, let's go back. Think about it. An inadvertent look Not only do we have adultery and all that goes involved with that, and pregnancy, we now have murder as a result of a failure to what we've heard this week, talked about Mike and Tom and others, you know, the control of lust and desires and wants. And we can learn a great lesson just from that. Sin, we're told, starts out small. And then it enlarges and enslaves and entraps. And James says, when sin has conceived and brought, it brings forth death. But we never see that. That's the problem. When we're in these situations, and it's not only, you know, in with regard to sexual sin and immorality, it's in other ways. We typically never see the end. We see the moment, we see the pleasure, we see the fulfillment of lust, we see perhaps the glory. All these things we see, the here and the now, what we do not see is what's at the end. And when we are in these situations, we want to ask ourselves a very, very important question. Where will or may this lead? Is this going to end here? Is this going to be the end of it all? Or will there be an enlargement and finally a much larger situation? That's exactly what happened to David. What are the steps in his fall, really? Obviously, there was a lack of sensitivity. The kings of Israel were told not to take multiple wives. We don't have time. It's fleeting. But Deuteronomy 17, we're told that. The kings of Israel were to be different than all the nations around them who had multiple wives. They were not to have multiple horses and silver and gold and all those. But 2 Samuel 5:13 says this regarding David, he took him more concubines and wives. That's direct disobedience to the word of God. And you can never do that and expect that the end is going to be something glorious. You see, what David did, he lowered his standard to that of society. He lowered his standard to that which was around him. We're not aware of it typically, but what happens is we practice relative separation. What happens is the church is here, the world is here, the world moves. We just move over to where it was. The world moves again, its standards go lower, we move over to where it was. The world moves again, we move over to where it was. And we keep saying all along, we're different than the world. We're not like them. But they have made these shifts and we have shifted right along with them. I'll just name some areas and you think about it. The way we dress. The way we talk. The vocabulary we use. I said it to you, those who have been in their past, that I hear language amongst young people that when I was your age, I would have got my mouth washed out for with soap. Actually, reality. And to you, it's casual. The things we view. The movies we go to. The books we look at and read. The videos we watch. In our day, obviously, didn't have DVD and all these things. And MP3 players and things like that. The values that you set. You live in a world that has much lower values than the world I grew up in. We rarely, if ever, heard of homosexuality. In my youth, I had a man pick me up. I was hitchhiking. We could hitchhike in those days. It was considered to be safe. And I had a man who picked me up, and he started to talk rather strange. And it was so obvious to me where he was headed. At the next stop, I said, I'll just get out here. But that was, you know, just about the only thing we would ever think of. Unless we thought someone was maybe strange in that way, we call them queer. In fact, that's what we called them in those days. But it was strange. Divorce was strange. Premarital pregnancies were almost unheard of. But you live in a world that is actually approving these. In fact, yesterday I read on this morning's headlines, the Supreme Court banned, or whatever, overturned a law in Texas that prohibited men from having sex one with another. You're living in a world that has extremely low values. And it would be easy for us to be slightly different in our values from the world, but be nowhere near what the Bible would want us to be and the Lord would want us to be. So he lacked sensitivity in the sense he lowered his standards. There was a relaxation, as we talked about that. You know, he should have been out fighting. And David took his armor off, and David, you know, took a spiritual break. And we won't say much more about that. But you know, the lust of the eyes, the unintentional temptation. But he did something, or did not do something, that another young man who was tempted in the scriptures did. And that was Joseph. Joseph was being enticed, you know, by Potiphar's wife. No one around again, you know. On his own. And by the way, there's a very good statement, and it's very healthy to remember. What we are when we're alone is what we really are. What we are when we're alone is what we really are. You know, no one's around. No one knows. Maybe what I'm reading. Maybe what I'm watching. Other things. That's more of a statement as to what we are. And Joseph was alone, but he did something that David didn't do. He ran. He literally ran. And the Bible tells us to flee fornication. And let me say something to you. There are times when you literally have to run. Prayer is not even the issue at this point in time. You're going to find yourselves in tempting situations in this world. And you have to run. You have to get yourself out of that situation. It may be you're watching television, something comes on, and you know it's not right, but you can just feel it almost like it's sucking you into the tube. Get out of the room. Turn it off, run, go outside, do something, but get out of it. Maybe you're alone with a person of the opposite sex and things are moving in a certain direction. One or both of you are to just, look, we got to get out of this. Run. Flee. And you know, the look became a stare. That's something as young guys and older guys we want to be careful of. You know, you come across, you have the inadvertent look, this passes in front of you. But the Lord said, you know, those who look upon a woman, and the point is those who stare, and then they internalize and they actually fulfill their desires in the sense of there's a mentalness, and he says they've committed adultery already. So it's sin. You remember Eve looked, and Lot's wife looked. The look became a stare. Beauty filled the eye. The Lord said, if your eye offend thee, pluck it out. That's pretty radical, isn't it? Sometimes it's going to take radical action. I mean, really radical action to get yourself out of these situations. And maybe, you know, if you're home alone and things are happening, maybe you're going to have to talk out loud to yourself, scream to yourself, get out of here, do something radical. I mean, call a friend. But whatever. Take whatever radical action is needed. The Lord also said, you know, if your hand offend thee, cut it off. And that to me is just such a tremendous illustration of hell. What the Lord was saying, you know, if your hand's going to send you to hell, cut it off. Which is a pretty descriptive way of saying, you know, hell must be a horrible place. If you have to take a radical action of cutting your hand off so you don't wind up there. The look became a stare, and then there was a fixation. Then there was a determination. Get her. Well, she's someone's wife. I don't care. Get her. There was a determination. He was warned to no avail. And then there was a rationalization. Someone wrote this. I'll just read it to you. And it's a book called The Myth of the Greener Grass. And remember, another little saying. Whenever the grass is greener on the other side, remember the water bill is higher. Okay? When the grass looks greener, there's a price to pay for that. Said Uriah is a great soul. This is the rationalization. He's thinking through David's mind. Uriah is a great soldier, but he's probably not much of a husband or a lover. Years older than she is. And he'll be away for a long time. This girl needs a little comfort in her loneliness. This is one way I can help her. No one will get hurt. I don't mean any wrong by it. This is not lust. I have known that many times. This is love. This is not the same as finding a prostitute on the street. God knows that. And then he says to the servant, bring her to me. We'll begin to rationalize. Not only again in immorality. I mean, it could be in gambling. Could be in drink. Could be in smoking. Could be in pornography. Could be in a multiple ways. This is the sequence. The inadvertent look, the stare, the fixation, the determination, the rationalization. All these things start to take over and the lust begins to control and the reality of God is lost. We get in a situation, the reality of God is lost. Somehow, he's put off way back on the back burner. One has said that Satan fosters not hatred, but forgetfulness of God. Think about that. Satan fosters the forgetfulness of God. Then there's a degeneration. You know, the fall amazes us, but the stubbornness that follows is even perhaps more amazing. A failure and an unwillingness to admit what he had done. It was a number of congresses ago when I spoke on this in more detail. And you remember Nathan came to David finally. And Nathan told him a story of someone who owned a a pet lamb, and another person who had multiple sheep. And the person with multiple sheep had visitors come to town, and he went over and stole the pet lamb and served it to him for dinner. And we would go, "Oh," or we'd say, "That's horrible. That's exactly what David said. That is horrible to think that someone would take someone's only lamb when he already had a lot of them." What's he saying? Let's rephrase it. In fact, he said that man should die. Isn't it horrible that a man would take the only wife of another man when he already had many of them? And when ultimately, you remember, it comes to the point where Nathan says, "Thou art the man." Only in Congress a number of years ago, some of you remember I said, "You the man." Just think of that. Someone's finally coming and bringing it to you. So remember that sin gets progressively worse. And he breaks five, ultimately, of the Ten Commandments. Didn't happen because he planned it. Didn't happen instantaneously, all of it. It unfolded over time. We want to learn from his failure. We really don't want to go away saying, "You know, it was horrible," and it was, but I just want to quickly mention some lessons that we can learn. I'm just going to basically mention them as we come to a close. The wickedness of the human heart. I hope and trust, obviously, particularly those who have come to know the Lord, that we have an understanding in that the wickedness, not of the human heart, but of my heart. That we can say that personally, the wickedness of my heart. Someone wrote, "Here we behold a saint, eminent in holiness, in an unguarded moment, surprised, seduced, and led captive by the devil. The flesh in the believer is no different and no better than the flesh in the unbeliever." You understand that? Your flesh is no better than the flesh in the unbeliever. And it's no better now than the day you got saved. Secondly, we learned that we need to complete the race. There is no rest when it comes to spiritual warfare. It's a moment by moment thing. The moment we let down our guard,